Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. The summer of 1968 was supposed to be a summer filled with lakeside activities for the Robeson family. However, their peaceful retreat ended in the brutal murder of every member of their family of six. 51 years later, this case remains unsolved. Who is responsible for their murders? Why couldn't this case be solved? This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. With John, I am Jamie, and we are here to bring you a unique case I hadn't heard of before. I'm excited, John. What do you think?
Hey, man. Yeah, this is one that's definitely was not on my radar, but just in doing some research for some other cases, I stumbled across this one, and I thought it would be a pretty interesting case to bring to our listeners. So before we take off with it, man, how's things going?
Yeah, things are good. I continue to be humbled by how many times people are downloading our episodes, so that's cool. We've made a few sales on our Etsy site where we have mugs, stickers, and mouse pads available. Authentic True Crime Cast merch, so please check that out. My wife hates that we use the word merch, by the way.
I know, and it seems like just such a hard thing to say, merchandise. I mean, that took seconds of my life. I will never get back.
It took me forever to spell it.
I'm not even going to try to spell it. But yeah.
Right?
So
yep.
We call it merch. Miss Jamie from True Crime Cast, if you're listening to this,
I'm trying not to be offended because I have a girl's name. My wife's name is not Jamie. But
right. I didn't want to say her real name or your last name.
She will not get any free merch.
Well, I'll be sure to give her a cup. I didn't mean it like that.
I took it like that. I'm leaving this in the podcast.
Fair enough. So anyway, if you would like to get a cup or any of our other merch, you can check out Etsy. You could also check out Patreon. Jamie, we spoke last week about if we could get 50 patron members, we're going to do a Q&A show where we'll take every question that you give us, we'll think about it, try to give an answer. I mean, if it's absolutely ridiculous, we're not even going to try, right? But if it's a legit question, we'll be happy to answer those.
I imagine we'll spend more time on the ridiculous ones, but I can't wait to do it, and we're inching closer. We're getting there. So don't think that we're 50 away. Your contribution could be one of the final steps to get us there.
So that sounds like a whole lot of fun. We really look forward to that. Every month we put out bonus episodes that I think are just a blast. I mean, we try to go lighthearted and silly. So you're getting, for low $3 a month, you're getting some bonus content that you're absolutely missing out on if you're not a Patreon member. We also have autographs on there that you can get. Last week's case with Blake Cruz was brought to you by a Patreon member who stepped up big time and paid a little extra money for her to be able to suggest the case for us to research. So all that is happening on Patreon. If you're not signed up, you're definitely missing out.
Also, I mean, if you're going to go on and buy our merchandise, you can just sign up for certain Patreon levels and actually save some money that way instead of just going on and buying things on Etsy. And it's the same stuff. So we encourage you to check that out. Really, the best way to support the show, as we always say, is rating and reviewing our podcast. We have a lot of people that say, I listen on Spotify or I listen on Stitcher or whatever. We can't do the iTunes podcast reviews, the Apple reviews, and that's fine. If you're on Facebook, we appreciate recommendations or reviews on there. If you're on Twitter, retweet some of our stuff, share our articles. Just tell your friends. Let people know. Let people know. We're almost at 70 episodes at this point. So if you get one friend to download every episode, I mean, that's a lot of downloads for us. We appreciate that.
Sounded like a lot of math. I'm going to boil it down to say thank you guys so much. And let's talk about some crime, shall we?
All right, man. This is one that you came up with, so you got to get us rolling.
All right. We're going to be talking about the Robeson family tonight. Now, this was a case that happened a long time ago. It's over 50 years ago. We're looking at 1968 when the Robeson family was taking a vacation to a lake house cabin that they had bought just short time before their vacation. They went there, and Jamie, unfortunately, the entire family was found murdered. So we're going to spend some time talking about that, and it's a pretty interesting case, so I hope you guys will find it as interesting as I have. I think the first place we need to start is just talking about the members of the family. Who are they? How old were they? I think it's pretty important to set up the rest of the story. Before we do that, I just think it's important to share that this family was an upstanding family in their community. It's through all the reports that I read, they were an awesome couple. They had great kids. They attended church regularly. They were reported to have no enemies. Now, we're going to talk about that a little later in the case. But the father was named Richard. He was 42 years old. Jamie, he was very successful. He owned an advertising company where he published an art magazine and did a lot of advertisements in that magazine. He was well-to-do. I mean, not only did they have their house they were living in, they were able to buy a lake house. I think that's in this society when you know you've made it, is when you can say that you own two houses, and that's where they were at. He worked really hard. Now, his wife, Shirley, was 40 years old. She did not work outside of the home. She stayed at home to take care of the family and take care of the house. They had children. We'll start with 19-year-old Richie was the eldest son. He attended Eastern Michigan University. It said that he was a great student and doing well in school. Then they had three younger children that still lived in the home. There was Gary, who was 17. There was Randy, who was 12. And Susan was 8 years old. And it said that all of these children were doing well in their studies. They had family friends that said they were smart children. They were very polite and just a great family all the way around.
Yeah, seems kind of like the all-American family, right? Like the American dream is what they're doing here. We're going to jump in the summer of 1968, John, where Richard and Shirley took their kids on vacation. You mentioned that they had a second home. That was up next to Lake Michigan. So they were going to go spend some time up there during that summer. They hadn't seen their friends in weeks, John, but, I mean, everybody kind of knew that they were taking a trip. They were up at their cabin and that they weren't going to be available. This was the 60s. Even landlines at that time, it was I remember when I was a kid, I had a party line. Do you know what that is?
Where? No, but you posted that on social media this week, and I thought, you're lying. Like, I know what it is, but I can't believe that a guy my age would have said that they had a party line.
Yeah, essentially we shared a phone line with our neighbor. So we would pick it up, and if they were on the phone, we would just hang up and wait till they got finished with it.
I mean, you are from Harlan, so I mean, I know they're really far behind the game. But
this is like late 80s, early 90s, so I mean, that was a thing then. So even landlines at a cabin up in Michigan, I mean, they're not planning on hearing from the Robinsons, right? So people aren't freaking out yet. Then there's a hot July day, and Chauncey Bliss was contacted by a neighbor of the Robinsons at the lake, at the cabin. There were a series of cabins and homes there. They reported an overwhelming smell coming from the area, John. Now, what I heard was that they assumed that it was just like a dead deer carcass or something coming from the woods, but they ultimately did track it to that cabin. Chauncey was a carpenter, and he'd actually built the cabin. And the other cabins that are around there, it was in an area called Blisswood, which sounds awesome. At the time, he was managing the cabins, and he reported that as he approached the cabin, that smell was overwhelming. He stepped on the porch, and he was expecting to have to go in the crawl space because he assumed this was some kind of dead animal. He knocked on the door and didn't get an answer. When no one answered, John, he went inside of their summer lake home there in Blisswood. Immediately, he saw a woman's body sprawled on the entryway. Her clothing was in disarray. Behind her, he saw several other bodies laying on the floor, pools of blood that had been dried. He was shocked, and he ran away to call the police. It was a horrific scene that he walked upon.
I think it's interesting that Chauncey was able to have a key to the house because he was like the manager of all these cabins. I thought it was interesting that he built all these cabins, so he was well familiar with the area, and then he also managed all these cabins. So just an interesting story. So yeah, Jamie, when police got to the scene, they were definitely taken back by what they saw. An initial search and investigation of the cabin revealed that all six members of this family had been murdered, from 42-year-old Richard all the way down to 8-year-old Susan. All of these family members were found to have been shot with a pistol. But I think one of the most interesting things about the bodies is that two of the victims were also hit with a hammer on the head. That would be 42-year-old Richard and his youngest daughter, Susan. I don't know. I just think it's interesting because I can't figure out why those two. Why weren't other members hit with a hammer? So it's just interesting to me. I don't know that we're going to have answers to that. But I think it's certainly something that we keep in mind as we go through the rest of this case. Jamie, a month had went by from the time these family members were murdered to when they were found. This is in July. It's a very hot month. It's probably unimaginable what the shape of their bodies would have been at the time. Jamie, due to the condition of the bodies when they were found, they were heavily decomposed. They were covered with flies. Officers were able to estimate that the murders took place about a month before the Robinsons were found. Authorities eventually placed the date and time of death as late afternoon or early evening of Tuesday, June 25th, 1968.
John, the bodies were all found in different rooms throughout the house. The bodies were spread out. Shirley was in the living room. She had been covered by a blanket after she was killed. There were three bodies in the hallway, and then there were two that were found in a bedroom. Like you mentioned, they were badly decomposed when they were found. He found that the curtains were drawn. Chauncey did when he approached the house. The front door was locked and the latch drawn inside, and there was a side door latch with a padlock. In a news article from 1968, they said that police were puzzled to find only one suitcase that was partially packed, even though it was a big family and they had planned to stay for a while. There was plenty of food in the home and they had some playing cards laying around. That's what we did to pass the time before we had phones. And there were bullet holes found in a window leading into the living room.
Emmett County Undersheriff Clifford Fossmore led the investigation as Sheriff Richard Zink was out of town at the time. Jamie, this is one of those situations where the sheriff leaves his town in the hands of an undersheriff, which is a term I'd never really heard of before. But while this guy is gone, I would be willing to bet that this is probably the worst crime that had been seen in this town before and probably after. And the main sheriff is out of town and not able to get back for some time. I mean, that's like worst case scenario, right?
Yeah, if you're thinking the sheriff's going to be out of town, what's the worst thing that could happen? It's definitely this.
He was able to come back, but it would be a few days before he would get back. In the meantime, a state police crime lab was opened up at the scene by the evening of July 22nd, and that was there in order to assist in gathering evidence of the home. The bodies were removed the following day and taken to an off-site autopsy space. Jamie, I didn't put it in my notes here, but I believe I remember from my research that they didn't want to take the bodies back to their normal crime lab because it just wasn't equipped for this type of situation. I mean, the bodies were in such bad shape. They didn't want to take them to the normal place. Is that what you remember?
Yeah, they weren't prepared for the level of decomposition and that kind of thing.
I didn't put this in the show notes, but this crime scene was so horrific and the smell and everything that was there was so bad. This cabin was not able to be saved. They had to tear this cabin down and completely demolish it because there was no coming back from what had happened in this home. It was determined that this family had been shot to death. And early evidence pointed to the possibility of two firearms being used in the killings. By July 26th, Sheriff Zink had returned back to aid in the investigation. There were many agencies involved. There were state police, and there were several folks actively working this case. The funeral took place for the Robinson family on July 26th in a town called Royal Oak. Work on this case was done kind of quietly for a long time. For the next few weeks, police released new information. On August 12th, there was an article released in a local newspaper, and by that time, Police said that they did not think the murders were committed by someone passing through the area, but rather by somebody who knew the family.
Yeah, John, as they started digging into Robinson's businesses, they pretty immediately came up with a suspect, or at least a lead in the case. The Robinson's businesses seemed to be running successfully. There were definitely some issues. With the magazine that he owned and operated, John, he had been telling people that there were a lot of deals coming up and that things were going on, but nobody knew a lot about it, and it seemed like there was some funny business or that he was just being kind of sketchy about this. One of the most revealing discoveries when they were digging into these books and records was that he had left his business in the hands of Joseph Scolaro, who was 30 years old at the time of this murder. He was an employee that had worked for Robinson for a while, but they later found out that he had been embezzling from Richard Robinson in this business, and the amount that they came up with was about $60,000, which is a lot in 1968. It's a lot now, but it's a lot of money. The theory that police came up with initially was that during a phone call between Robinson and Scolaro a few hours before they were killed, Robinson had told Scolaro that he had found out about the embezzlement. And at that point, they say that Scolaro panicked, drove from Detroit to Lake Michigan, killed the family, and then left before Richard Robinson could let anybody else know about the crime or about the embezzlement.
Yeah, so Jamie, 12 hours during that day, Scolaro is out of touch with his business associates, his family, and his friends. Nobody knows where he's at for 12 hours. So that's definitely not good news when you're trying to produce an alibi for police. Another piece of evidence that they found was that Scolaro had a weapon that he would go and take to the shooting range every now and then. They were able to go to the shooting range and collect shells from a gun that matched the casings that were found at the crime scene. So here you have Scolaro, who has a weapon that matches the weapon that was used at the crime scene. So, I mean, in my mind, that's pretty telling evidence. Jamie, he also failed two polygraph tests, and he delivered inconclusive results on a third test. Now, I know if you are a loyal listener to this show and you've listened to all of our previous episodes, we don't put a whole lot of stock into polygraph tests. But when you're given three of them, you fail two of them, and the third one's inconclusive, it's really hard to say you're innocent. I mean, none of those tests would show that you are. So I at least put a little bit of stock into it. I hope I'm not being hypocritical on previous comments I've made, but I mean, it seems fair to say that this is not looking good for him, right?
Yeah, that's certainly not a good start to him defending himself, especially after he doesn't have anybody to support the alibis that he tried to establish being gone for so long. But, you know, police couldn't find any murder weapons. They didn't find a gun, the gun at the scene. And there were no eyewitnesses to the crime itself. So the prosecutor in Emmett County at that time, where the cabin was located, chose to not press any charges. Frustrated by this, state police officers started working with prosecutors in Oakland County, which is where the Robinsons lived most of the time, to continue the investigation. In 1973, Oakland County prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson was ready to charge Scolaro with conspiracy to commit murder. However, before he could be arrested, Scolaro shot himself in the head, ending Brooks' attempt to prosecute him. Scolaro left behind a suicide note, John. Now, this wasn't a confession note. He actually said in this note that he did not kill this family, but that he couldn't handle the pressure of people thinking that he did. And, you know, as far as suspects go, if you talk to people from the sheriff's office in Oakland County or in Emmett County, people still think he's the chief suspect.
Jamie, there's a few other theories about this case, but I don't think none of them are really as strong as the possibility of Scolaro. There's another theory out there, and that involves the suspect named John Norman Collins. Now, John was convicted of killing a female college student in 1970 in a town really close to the Goodhart murders. What is interesting about this fellow, John Norman Collins, we mentioned earlier that the oldest son attended Eastern Michigan University. Jamie, it's alleged, and I don't know if it's 100% clear or not, but it's suspected that the oldest son, Rich, shared a room with John Norman Collins. So there was at least a tie to this family. Now, I don't know that you can get from they shared a room together one night, so this guy drove out to their cabin and murdered the whole family. I don't see that. I don't know that we have any evidence pointing to that, but that is a theory out there that I found, so I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, you know, John, I didn't see that name in my research, so when you brought it up just now, the first thing I thought is that you said three names. So I thought you were going to say this guy was a serial killer that just happened to be in the area, so they were trying to pin it on him. Because usually when we mention three names, they've killed a lot of people.
I'm about to make your day. You ready for
this?
Let's
do it.
He is suspected in other murders, but he has not been found guilty of those at this time. So he may very well be a serial killer. And based upon his name, I think we just run with the theory that he is. But we don't know that he killed the Robinson family.
Okay.
But yeah, interesting call, and good job.
Yeah, thanks, man. You'd think I'd read this before we show up, right?
It's all right. So there's another theory, and I want to start this one off by saying I think this is complete ridiculous speculation, but here it is. So the man who found the Robinson family was Chauncey Bliss. Unfortunately, right before the Robinson family was murdered, Chauncey lost his son. What happened was his son and one of the Robinson boys were out on a motorcycle, and Chauncey's son got killed in a motorcycle accident. Now, I read that Richard went to kind of be there and show his support for Chauncey. He brought some flowers over to the Chauncey's house and just offered his condolences for their loss. Some people actually speculate that because Chauncey may have thought that one of the Robinson boys was at fault or could be responsible or even just jealous that it was his son that got killed and not one of the Robinson's kids, that he actually went to the cabin, murdered this family. I almost hated throwing this in the outline, but it is a theory that some people suspect. I think it is complete garbage. I just wanted to tell you about what I found.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other evidence to support that besides a potential motive, which any forensics people we talked to, we had Kristen on the show sometime last month. Most of the time when you're looking, you need to dismiss motive and look at the forensic pieces first. And there's really nothing that ties him to it forensically, so I wouldn't buy him as a suspect either. John, there have been several others that have been suggested and discarded. And unlike a lot of cases we bring on True Crime Cast, this one's still unsolved. I know we've had a few of those, and we've had several where we've disagreed with the conclusion, but this is still an open case. It's open-ended. 51 years later, the community of Goodhart remains a popular vacation spot. Some people from downstate Michigan head up to Lake Michigan to get some time to themselves. Unfortunately, the Robinsons' attempt to get some time to themselves ended in a violent encounter, after which they would never return. So, John, we mentioned a few of the most popular theories. Which one do you buy? You kind of already poo-pooed on Chauncey being a suspect here.
Yeah, I guess I should have held all that inside for the part we're about to talk about, but I really don't think you can say that Chauncey's a suspect here. I think it's just awful timing, and you know, there's no forensic evidence, like you said, that would point to him in any means as a suspect. The John Collins serial killer suspect, you know, you said earlier that we should dismiss motive, but if you look at the potential motive between the three people that we have as possible suspects, doesn't it seem most likely that the one with the most motive to kill Mr. Robinson would be Scolaro? I mean, this guy's going to go down for stealing $60,000 from his boss. So it makes sense to me that he would want to get rid of the lead witness in this case before it even goes to court, right? So if you look at motive, I think Scolaro is your guy. But unfortunately, I wish that we had more physical evidence tying him. I think the shell casings are huge, and I think that's something that we should definitely consider. But I wish we could have stuff like fingerprints, putting him in the home. I wish we could have an eyewitness who would have perhaps saw him in the area. I think the thing that really trips me up and puzzles me is this, and I didn't put this in the outline, but we're talking about a lake cabin in the middle of July, and when police come into this cabin, they found that there had been a heater running the whole time this family had been laying there dead. So I guess what happened and what's speculated is that in the evening or in the early morning hours, it may have been a little chilly in this house, so someone had turned on the heater. But once they were murdered, nobody was there to turn that off. So these bodies would have been just unimaginably decomposed, being there for around a month and the heat being on. And I mean, you can imagine the mess that was there. Jamie, in 1968, can we say that they had the means to pinpoint exactly the day and the hour in which these crimes had taken place? Because they did that. I mean, they said it was the evening hours on June 25th. But do you think the science was there to back up that very specific date?
I mean, a lot of the forensic cases we cover are more modern, and we have science now where we can say, based on certain types of composition, we can pinpoint it. But even then, it's kind of relative. They'll put a range on it, and I realize they did that. But even now, John, given the weather at the lake, given how hot it was outside, and when you factor in the heat inside, I feel like that throws your math off. Like, I don't know, I have a math degree, and I realize a lot of this science that goes into predicting these timelines uses those factors. And I feel like that just creates such a variable that you can't control for. They don't know what temperature it was inside the house the entire time. They don't know on a 90-degree day what it felt like inside the house versus on a 70-degree day what it felt like inside the house. And they may have had some of both of those days during this time frame. So I feel like there's so much unpredictability within this time frame that for them to say that it was on a specific day, even if they gave it a whole day, which they didn't, I feel like that's just ignorant and short-sighted. But again, I'm not a forensic specialist, but that's just what I observe. And I think even now we would have a hard time determining something like this.
Exactly. But they did narrow in on that day and time. Unfortunately, or fortunately, however you look at it, Scalero was unable to really identify his whereabouts that day for those 12 hours. So that's damning on him if you look at this case definitely happened on June 25th, the day that Scalero is unable to account for his entire whereabouts. But in my mind, I don't think that's fair, because what if the crime happened on the 26th and Scalero could tell you exactly where he was and has witnesses putting him in that place? So in my mind, just the fact that this was caught a month after it happened, I don't think you can definitively say with 100% certainty that this crime happened at this hour on this day. And that makes it really hard, in my mind, to prosecute Scalero. And ultimately, they never did. I mean, they never charged him with anything.
Now, we may get an email from a forensic scientist telling us we're idiots and this is super easy. I don't know. I have the microphone. You don't. So I'm going to disagree with that already. But I agree with you. I feel like this is the only piece of information you would need in your reasonable doubt file to where this wasn't going to be a successful prosecution. Unless there are things that Prosecutor Brooks Patterson had in his back pocket that we're not aware of, I just don't see how this moves forward. Now, it kind of does bring up then why would he kill himself? Also, are we sure he killed himself? Again, this is a long time ago. Science was shaky. Investigation techniques were shaky. If you want to start going on conspiracy theories, maybe he was silenced as well. I don't know. I mean, I realize that's out there, but if we're going there, if we're using science to say something happened a month ago and unpredictable temperatures with body decomposition, I don't think it's far-fetched to say that his suicide may not have been legitimate.
I certainly didn't find anything in my research suggesting that anybody speculated on that, but I guess you're right as far as it's possible. I think that if we use, Occam's razor to suggest that the solution is often the most simple solution, I think that Scalero knew that his life was about to be ruined because of his embezzlement. He potentially murdered this family, and when he felt the heat being turned up in the investigation on him, he killed himself. I think that's the most likely scenario, but of course, we don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the most likely scenario, but I don't think there's any way that this is beyond a reasonable doubt for me. I don't think that I can definitively say that he did it. However, of the suspects that we have, I do think he is the most likely. But even going back and looking, John, at some of the odd things that they found at the crime scene, with some people being shot, some people being hit with a hammer, like, first question is, did one person do this? Did you shoot some people and then get a hammer out of your pocket? And if they did, what was their reason for varying things up? Did they not have enough ammunition? Could they not change it out fast enough? I don't know. There are just so many unanswered questions here that there are a lot of holes in any theory that you're going to come up with, unless there's some just real strong evidence that comes forward. And I don't know if you were going to ask this. We usually say, do we think this case will be solved? Not so confident on this one. This seems like it's too long ago, too little information. It seems like the one person that may have had some information has killed himself. So I'm afraid this one won't be solved.
Yeah, I would. Last week we covered a case about the murder of a young man, Blake Cruz, and that happened about 4 years ago. And I hope that, yes, that case will be solved. But this one, over 51 years ago, the main suspect has committed suicide and is no longer on this earth to answer any questions. I don't know that we're going to have an answer. I think this is one of those that is going to go on in the history books as an unsolved case. I don't know where we are with time, but I would like to speculate. Why do you think, if Scolaro is the one who did this, you know, there's some interesting stuff at the crime scene that you mentioned. I think it's interesting that Richard was probably the first one shot. He was shot from outside through a window while he was sitting on his couch. The bodies were arranged in a very odd way. When you walked in the main door, the body of Shirley was positioned in such a way to make detectives think that she had been sexually assaulted in some way.
But she wasn't, right?
There's no evidence saying that she was, but her body was positioned to make detectives think that she was. I found that very odd. And then just the deal with the hammer. If Scolaro was the one who did this, was his anger at Richard manifested by the extra attention through the hammer? And
if so, why?
With Susan, yeah. You know? I mean, is that like you're so angry that what could hurt this guy more is seeing his daughter hit in this way? I mean, it's all interesting stuff. I guess we could speculate on it, but we'll never know with 100% certainty.
And some of it may have been to throw off detectives. You mentioned they might have wanted to make it look like a sexual assault, or maybe they used the hammer to make it look like there were multiple people. I don't know. Some people are intelligent in such a way where they do try to throw red herrings out there, and that could have been part of it too. Why do you think he wasn't charged initially?
So, Jamie, I spent some time thinking about that, and I think the bottom line is there just wasn't enough evidence. Even though we had the bullet casings from the range and the house that were a match, there wasn't anything else tying him to the scene that day. Even though his whereabouts were unknown on the date and time that they thought that this crime was committed. And that's very frustrating because I think, well, those two are enough. But I can't say that because if you go back and listen to our past episodes about Kevin Cooper and some of those other guys that were wrongfully accused of murder, I'm thankful that police don't jump the gun too often and too easily and arrest people who may be completely innocent of these crimes. So it's frustrating that we don't have justice. We don't have somebody being held responsible. At the same time, I think it's great police work not to jump in and arrest somebody when you don't have enough to actually prove that they're guilty.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, like I said, I feel like there's reasonable doubt in there. And maybe the initial prosecutor was focused on that. But you fast forward 5 years and somebody was ready to move forward. So I have to wonder if he had additional information that we don't have access to that he wouldn't have put out to the public unless there was a trial of some kind. And I think that's probably likely if he did feel comfortable going forward, but we may never know.
Yeah, I think any good detective will always have a card that they're not showing to everybody, a trick up their sleeve or whatever you want to call it. I think that's I hope that's possible. I wish that we could get our hands on whatever that was so that we could say with more certainty who we suspected this, but I think this is going to be one of those, like I said, that's just going to go throughout history never being solved, and that's so unfortunate that this family went there to relax, went there to have a good time, and ultimately it's the thing that is like our worst nightmare. There has been movies based on this. I don't know, Jamie, if you remember, we took a vacation really early in our friendship with our before our children were even born to a cabin in Tennessee. There was like three couples, no kids. It was the most relaxing vacation I can remember. But if you remember, there was a movie that came out right around there where a family went to a cabin and were murdered. Do you remember that? Am I making this up?
No. There's.
Do you remember the name of that movie, though?
I remember strangers happening, but I think that was more at a home. I don't remember one specifically about a cabin, but there have been those, and that's frightening. And anytime I go on vacation, I'm on extra alert because of stories like this and movies like that.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that that movie came out shortly before we got a cabin in the woods. So we were, I think we were all just a little freaked out, but stuff like this actually happens. So, Jamie, any last thoughts before we wrap this one up?
No, this is a good one. Thanks for bringing it out. We don't do a lot of unsolved stuff, but I think it's good to mix those in. And this is a case I wasn't familiar with, but certainly an interesting one. And I think this is one that, I don't know, like I said, when I go on vacation, I'm on extra guard because of stories like this. And this is exactly the type of thing that's in my mind, unfortunately, when I'm out there away from things, wherever that may be. Thanks for listening, guys. Thanks for coming along for the ride. We got some really good stuff coming up. We're going to be putting out a new Patreon episode next week. You're really going to want to be a part of our Patreon community. Check that out. As long as you sign up by the first day of the month and that Patreon processes that in time, you will have access to those cases. So please sign up and become a part of that community. Get that bonus content. We also do some extra giveaways over there for our Patreon friends. And we would love to see you on there.
Guys, until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.